Time of Merrill, 03 to 06, when you're growing the business and becoming the number one, and became the number one CEO issue. Who's your competition?
It's all of the banks and investment banks.
Did, we had talked before about your comp and one of the inputs on that, one of the factors impacting that, the revenue that your group generated. Did your market share or where you stood compared to the competition impact your comp at all, do you know?
I would think that they're correlated. Certainly,
sure.
Something that we would have talked about in comp related discussions. How you're doing relative to competitors, I think, is something that generally is considered to be important.
When you left Merrill in, I think, ballpark February 06, I think you mentioned earlier today that for like a month you were in like a transition period.
Yes.
Can you provide some color on that? What did you mean?
Well, when I told them that I wanted to leave, we spent some time sort of documenting my exit agreement. And during that time, they asked me not to work, not to show up on the floor, et cetera. So I either didn't come in or I sat in my office and we worked on the documents.
So you told Merrill you wanted to leave December 2005 ballpark?
No, it was in January. It was like beginning of January, I believe. I can't remember the exact date. But it was approximately that month of January, which was like that downtime. I can't remember the exact dates, but in and around there.
Okay. And then I know, I don't know that we brought it, and even if we did, I don't know that they need to show it to you, but I think there was a written agreement that you entered into with Merrill.
Is that accurate?
Generally, what was the purpose of the agreement? I think I remember seeing one thing in there that Merrill had to, like, had to write a first refusal on deals that Cohen was going to manage. That. And here it is.
There it is.
If it helps jog memory bells. Who asked for this and describe to me the events that lead up to it?
Cohen was a client of Merrill's in this business, and Merrill didn't want to lose the business just because I left. And I think they saw that they could get this agreement because Cohen wanted to hire me and some other people. And this was what was worked out.
Okay. When you told Merrill you wanted to leave, did that come as a surprise to them? Do you know?
That's hard to say. I don't know.
I mean, were there any issues, as I'll term it generically, between you and the firm before you told them that you wanted to go to Cohen?
No, I mean, we had a successful business, and I was always looking, like everyone is, I think, always looking for good internal opportunities, and it just so happened that a better external opportunity came about.
For example, like before the Cohen opportunity came, had anything like, hey, look, I think I should be getting paid more, and I'm unhappy that you're not paying more, or anything else, that any dissatisfaction you have with the firm?
Well, I think everyone always thinks they should be getting paid more. I'm sure that's true of everyone at this table and just broadly, but there was no sort of pointed disagreement on compensation. I was looking, for an expanded management role, which was, being discussed. Certainly the door is not shut to that. Then again, there was no, imminent expansion of responsibilities at that point in time either. So.
And any of your superiors or else Merrill express any dissatisfaction with your performance before the time you left?
Not that I know of.
Did anyone try to get you to stay when you first told them?
Yeah. A lot of people, I think Jeff Kronthal in particular, was leading the charge.
in that regard? Was there something that you said, do this and I'll stay, and they were unwilling to do it?
I don't know if it was that definitive. I definitely let it be known that I would be interested in expanded management responsibilities. I don't think it was, you know, give me Kronenthal's job or I'm out of here kind of thing, but it was, you know, I want to do more, let's find, you know, other things. And that would be one piece of, you know, attractiveness to considering the internal versus the external options.
Mm-hmm. Generally in the 03 to 06 time from New York Merrill, did you have much interaction with Mr. O'Neill?
Less than you would think from reading the papers. We had probably two meetings, and he attended, I think, one or maybe two of our client events.
And when you said he attended one or two of your meetings, again, I take it you're talking about the structured credit, I'm butchering it again, your group.
The structured credit products. Yeah, I think he attended, maybe it was just one client event we had, a golf outing. Oh, and we were all at the one or two sort of senior management offsite meetings that Merrill had for their global markets division.
Were you a member of any management committees?
No, but, you know, I was a member of the, you know, whatever that group of senior managers was that generally attend these types of offsites. Maybe it was the, you know, whatever, top 100 global managers or something like that.
Were you a member of the operating committee?
No.
I take it you weren't a member of the executive committee.
No.
Okay, so I know when you leave and go to Cohen & Company, Cohen does business with Merrill Lynch. Just generally, and tell me if this runs afoul, just generally describe the nature of the business between Cohen and Merrill after you leave.
Depends
whether, I mean, I'm fine with that.
General description. I mean, well, you can see that Cohen agreed to give a certain number of their mandates plus a right of first refusal or last look or however it's structured on some of the CDO transactions for a period of time. So there's that, which and those happened as far as I know. And in addition to that, you know, Cohen is a client, you know, buy-side client like others. Bought bonds from Merrill. I don't have the exact details, but probably did a lot of buying and selling with Merrill's big in bond trading business. Cohen is a reasonably active participant as well. I'm sure there are a lot of trades.
Okay. And I'll tell you, we've at least seen in some information provided by Merrill that in 06 and 07, Cohen was buying CDO notes from Merrill. Is that consistent with your recollection?
It is.
Okay. And who were you dealing with at Merrill in terms of Cohen being a collateral manager or Cohen buying CDO tranches from Merrill?
Are we leaving the Merrill portion of this, or are we going to come back to it?
We may be leaving it for good. I'm not sure. Are you asking people to leave or something?
Well, if we're going to talk about Cohen, it would be easier if we did.
Okay.
I mean, if you wanted to sort of temporarily do that, probably, you know, have them step in the other room if you're not sure.
I mean, that's where I am now. I mean, I'm going to be talking about Merrill in post-February of 06.
Yeah, well, I'm going to ask you guys to go.
I feel bad.
I'm taking you.
Especially since we're
Thank you. question.
Who are you dealing with at Merrill in terms of being collateral manager duties and actually purchasing CDO tranches from Merrill?
Well, the purchasing of CDO tranches, like purchasing of any bonds, is done by the bond portfolio managers, which isn't me. I was definitely involved in, you know, sort of discussions about getting CDO deals in the Merrill pipeline. So this kind of thing, right? Because even though this covered a lot of deals, there's still more, I think, that happened beyond these. And, you know, there are a lot of details that happen in just like the actual doing of the deal that has nothing to do with the portfolio management aspect, which, as I said, is covered by others.
So let me add, you've probably seen in the financial press or otherwise, even back at the time, that it's at least been reported, and in fact Mr. O'Neill admitted during the October 24th, 2007, 3Q07 earnings call, that beginning in late 06, early 07, they started trying to reduce warehouse risk by constructing CDOs, retaining the super senior tranches, and selling off the rest.
I heard that.
Other than Mr. O'Neill saying that on October 24th, did you know that from many conversations with Merrill at the time, being late 06, early 07?
I'm not exactly sure if it, you know, how, not exactly sure if I, and obviously I wasn't inside of Merrill, so, you know, everything I'm getting, I'm sort of getting from bits and pieces and, you know, various parts of conversations. So it's hard to really pinpoint exactly what I knew about their strategy.
The reason I ask is because during that time, you guys are collateral managers for some of their deals, and you are buying CDO tranches from Merrill during that time. That's why I ask.
Okay.
That helps jog memory bells.
Certainly Merrill, I'm not in, you know, on the inner circle of Merrill's strategy regarding how they're managing their warehouse risk in 2007, or whatever you said, or any time after I left, right? We still had a lot of dealings with them, including on, you know, doing transactions, as you said. I don't recall anyone ever saying, hey, you know, we're going to do some strategy of, you know, de-risking or whatever they called it in that article, and you're involved, and here's the role you're playing in. I don't remember any such conversation like that. Does that answer your question?
Sure. And yes, I will now ask more questions. Did you know, or did you have any discussions with anyone at Merrill where they had told you, where our warehouse risk is increasing and we're going to try to deal with it? Or two, you know, we do have this strategy where we're going to be having a larger amount of retained positions on book because it's part of our strategy to reduce the warehouse risk, or words to that effect.
You know, I mean, I feel like I did, you know, generally understand that they were, you know, sort of active in trying to reposition themselves. I don't know that I had a lot of details or anything like that, but, you know, I feel like there are anecdotes at the time that led me to believe that, but I'm not really sure.
Who, if anyone, were did you, you know, remain in contact with at Merrill after you left?
I mean, a lot of people. You know, all of the old people worked in my group. A lot of their traders and salespeople as well.
In
seem at conferences, and
sure,
you have, you know, conversations with them, and they have conferences and whatever.
In the June-July 06 time frame, Mr. Krontel and several other executives were let go. Did you have any discussions with any of those individuals about that reorganization?
I don't think I spoke with any of those people after the fact, maybe with the exception of Jeff Chandler. I think I a little bit of one conversation or an email or something like that with Jeff Chandler. Just, you know, what's he doing? And he set up a new fund, and I actually think we've done some business with this fund or something like that after that. But
Other than that, do you recall any discussions with anyone about why the reorganization or how these folks felt about it?
I don't recall.
Okay. You may have also seen, since you've clearly read some of these articles that I have too, that after you left, Mr. Kim reportedly said, you know, we're going to do whatever it takes to maintain the number one position as a CEO issuer.
Mm-hmm. I read that,
summarizing yep. what it was. Do you have any discussions with anybody at Merrill or know anything about that?
No. I don't remember any discussions about that.
Any discussions with Mr. Kim at all after you left Merrill?
I don't think I spoke with him at all.
Okay. When...
Sorry.
Can you need a minute?
No, I was just trying to check on a flight. Sorry, I wouldn't do this otherwise.
They told me about your flight. We'll get you on
okay.
that flight.
Okay, fine. let me just confirm that. Okay.
Unless good. You keep looking at that flight, you know. My joke. So again, going back to this de-risking strategy that, one, I've read about in the Financial Press, and two, O'Neill admitted in the October 24th, 2007 conference call, and three, I will tell you, I've seen in the documents that Merrill has produced. Again, you know, that along with us seeing in the document that Cohen and Company, you know, was a collateral manager for deals and was buying CDO tranches. I just want to get whatever your recollection is about any conversations or dealings you had with Merrill in terms of that strategy and who they were with.
I mean, you know, I generally recall, I mean, let's take a step back. Merrill's people, whether they're, you know, ABS people or CDO people or leverage loan people or whatever, they're always trying to sell their stuff, not just Merrill, everyone. That's the business, right? You do transactions, you're in the market, you're offering things for sale, you're trying to sell them, right? So it's, I mean, I may have had hundreds of conversations with Merrill people, generally along the lines of they want to sell stuff and they want to sell it to others, including us. All right, so I don't. There was no. But having said that, I don't know that there was any sort of special arrangement or anything or special proposal or anything like that, other than just they want to sell stuff, and they're, you know, constantly pushing people to buy. Right.
But understanding, and that, I guess that's sort of my point. Of course, everybody always wants to sell it.
Yeah,
apparently something happened towards the end of 06 where they were unable to sell it.
Well, as I understand the de-risking thing, as it was reported, it's a little bit different than just trying to sell stuff, right? That is not, the de-risking strategy is not trying to sell stuff. The de-risking strategy was, let's retain stuff, right? That's what sort of is unusual about it, right? Let's start doing this CDOs and retain a lot of the super seniors. That, I think, is the change in what makes it notable. Isn't that your understanding?
My understanding, and from what I've seen in the documents and read, is that up pretty much through February of 07, they were still pretty bullish, and they were increasing both warehouse risk and the retained positions were not that high because they were still in the business of selling.
Right.
Under $10 billion, I think.
Right.
And then at that time, they realized, all right, you know, for whatever reason, we're going to change our strategy and try to reduce our warehouse risk.
Right.
And the way we're going to do that is to construct CDOs, retain the super seniors,
right,
and get rid of the subordinate tranches.
Right.
And then you see a reduction in warehouse exposures and
right,
a fairly substantial increase in super senior exposures.
Right. Yes.
So that's what I see in the documents. And I
yes,
guess what I, and since I see that, and I see Cohen and Company both being collateral manager on some of these deals in late 06 and
mm-hmm,
07 and buying notes in 06 and 07. Again, I know I keep asking the same thing, and I'm hoping it jogs memory bells. Discussions you had with Merrill about, hey, yes, we are now having this, now we're not comfortable with our increase warehouse exposures and we're going to do this, and here's how you guys can help us.
I mean, I don't remember specifically anything like that, but again, it wouldn't necessarily seem different to me that they wanted to sell, you know, the below super senior notes, because they always wanted to sell those notes, right? I mean, you see what I'm saying?
So I do.
Yeah. So it isn't like they said, hey, Chris, we're going to do this, you know, strategy, and, you know, there's something different about this than before. It's just, we're doing these deals. You know, we want our clients that are appropriate to buy these classes. They want them to buy them, mm-hmm. right? The difference, I think, is in their retention of the
super senior.
The super senior, right?
Did you have any?
No.
No.
I just want to make sure I'm clear because, you know.
I hear you. No, and I appreciate that. Do you have any discussions with anyone at Merrill about that strategy of retaining the super seniors? As like, why? And
you know, definitely over the years, I have, right? And, you know, in part because, you know, in retrospect, it did not work out, and so discussions about why they thought that was a good strategy at the time, and it turned out not to be, right?
Do you know, tell me who you talked to and what they said, and generally, I mean, were they saying that they simply couldn't sell the super senior?
Start with who you talked to.
I mean, it's sort of, talk to everyone, right? I mean, this is just, you know, it's in the paper and stuff. I mean, everyone's talking about it. So, right. I mean, I talked with, I don't know, probably like almost literally everyone I know at Merrill and a lot of other places too, just because you're talking about everyone's talking about it.
When did you talk about it? I'm not sure.
Let's break it down since I asked a triple compound question there. So when did you first talk to somebody at Merrill about the strategy of retaining the super seniors?
I don't remember.
Okay. Who did you first talk to at Merrill about the strategy of retaining the super seniors?
I don't remember who I first talked to. Some of the guys that I speak to most frequently in general are the people that, you know, I used to work with in my old group that were still there.
And that is?
Herman Da Silva, Andy Phelps, Cecilia Pan, Zach Smith, you know, guys like that.
So understanding you don't remember when, at
not
least
exactly.
Specifically, was it at the time the strategy was being pursued, or was it, you know, after, for example, like after 3Q07 when they announced the first write-down,
I'm not sure if that helps. I'm not sure.
Okay. Understanding, you know, timing, describe for me the discussions on what the folks that you were talking to told you about why that strategy was being followed.
Sure. I mean, I think that, as generally described, they thought that this is, you know, they had a warehouse size, and this was a way to, you know, reduce it and to effectively reduce the risk of the warehouse, because they felt as though if you do this and sell the lowest classes, that you reduce the risk. Or eliminated it, or whatever.
I get that.
That is the theory, yeah.
I get the reducing the warehouse exposure
okay.
part. Any discussions about retaining the super senior exposure part?
Oh. No. I mean, I assume that they couldn't sell it, or they couldn't sell it at that level, or whatever.
And when you say at that level?
Oh, at the level that they actually took it down at.
I'm not sure I'm following you.
When they finally did it, it priced at a certain level, and they took it.
Okay.
Guessing it's, you know, because no one else wanted it at that level. But there is some level at which it would have sold.
Level meaning price.
Price.
Thank you.
Price or spread. Yeah.
Okay. Did anybody, do you recall if anybody at Merrill told you we can't sell the super senior at a price we're willing to sell it at?
I think yes, but I think later. I'm not really, you know, there's a lot of time in here and a lot of discussion.
Sure,
so
and putting aside
really
the timing of
yeah.
it, Who do you recall telling you that?
I don't know.
One of those four people that you mentioned earlier?
Could have been, or it could have been others. Dave Moffitt is another one that I speak with a lot. Rehan Barani. I mean, there are a lot of these people
right.
We talk.
I understand.
You know, a lot. So could have been any of those people. And but it also is obvious, right? It almost doesn't need to be said. Right?
I hear you.
Right.
Similar, somewhat different question. Did anybody at Merrill ever tell you they didn't sell the Super Senior because they couldn't sell it at a price? Because they could only sell it at a price that would require them to book a loss.
I don't remember having that conversation.
Okay. Is in your mind, is that different than talking about being unable to sell it at a level or a price that they were willing to sell it at?
It's a little different because, you know, one goes to, who knows, maybe they really wanted to make a lot of profit, and I don't know, there's like a difference in their what their motivations were, right? Mm-hmm. Second one goes to setting, you know, the level where they would or wouldn't have a loss. First one, maybe they just really wanted to make a lot of profit, and that's why they, I don't really know.
Sure. Did you follow the company after you left? Like, for example, did you read their quarterly earnings releases or listen to the conference call or read the transcript or read their Qs or Ks?
I don't think I followed it that closely. I mean, I retained a decent size position in their equity, so I was following the stock price, unfortunately. But
right.
Yeah. But I don't think I got involved in conference calls or anything like that.
Okay, again, and I think I've asked this, but generally, did you know about this de-risking strategy at the time it was going on, or did you just find out about it after the fact?
I'm not sure. I don't think I knew about it at the time, or it wasn't obvious exactly what was going on, but I can't say for sure.
Okay, and again, I'm just going to see if this helps jog memory bells. On October 24th is when they announced 3Q07 results. Actually, back up. On October 5th, they pre-announced that they plan to take a $4.5 billion write-down
right.
on the ABS CDOs.
Right.
And then 19 days later, they announced, well, we really meant 7.9.
Right.
I think 6.9,
yeah.
and that's
yeah.
the ABS CDOs, and a billion of it is on other subprime
right.
positions. Do recall, does that jog memory bells and help you recall whether or not you knew about this de-risking strategy of retaining super senior CDOs before that either October 5th pre-announcement or the October 24th final announcement of 3Q07 earnings?
I don't recall.
When you heard about pre-announcement or the 3Q07 announcement, do you reach the jog memory bells on, did you then have conversations with folks about, you know, well, what's going on?
I'm pretty sure that I did. I can't remember details, but it would have been, you know, been natural for me to talk to them and sort of discuss it. It's front page news.
Okay. And I mean, I hear you saying you don't recall details, but what do you recall, if anything, about any conversations you had shortly around or after either the pre-announcement or the October 24th 3Q07 call?
I don't really generally discussing the issues, but I'm not sure. I can't remember any details of the discussions.
Okay, and let me try to cut it short. As I'm sure you know, every quarter going forward through 4Q08 and the B of A acquisition, they announce more write-downs
right. mm-hmm.
In addition to write-downs on non-ABS CDO, whether it's subprime all day or the U.S. bank investments,
mm-hmm.
and then the allowances on the hedges that they had
mm-hmm.
acquired from the monolines and others.
Right.
And again, given that progression from October to January to April to July to September, et cetera. Again, just if you can, let us know what kind of discussions you're having with folks at Merrill about what's going on there, if any.
I mean, I don't remember any detailed discussions. I probably, like everyone else, was just generally talking about what the issues were.
Mm-hmm. As you probably recall, 6 days after the October 24th, 2007 earnings call, Merrill announces that O'Neill's retiring. Mm-hmm. And a couple weeks later, they announced that Thane's going to join as CEO effective December 1. Mm-hmm. Does that jog any memory bells about any conversations with folks at Merrill about what's going on in that time frame, late October, early November?
Of 2007.
Okay.
A long time ago.
Chris, I would also point out that after some point in 07 was when, my guess is everybody at Merrill who, current former people began to be advised by counsel they shouldn't be talking about historical events and having the ordinary chatter that would happen, read things in the paper, because there was interest by government agencies and by others, and lawsuits began to be filed and that sort of thing. So just to put a context on that, I don't think it's unnatural.
Sure.
There weren't conversations.
I didn't mean to imply otherwise.
I think you were, but you were recording it.
So going back to the late 06, early 07 time frame, do you recall either having any conversations with folks at Merrill or hearing from folks at Cohen & Company, hey, Merrill is pursuing this de-risking strategy of constructing CDOs and retaining the super seniors and getting rid of the subordinate tranches, and they want our help. And they want our help either in terms of us, in terms of us being collateral managers for these deals, or in terms of buying subordinate notes for either your own account or for other CDOs.
I don't remember sort of specific conversations. Like I said, I remember generally lots of conversations where Merrill is, trying to sell stuff, including CDOs. However, as I said, other people are the ones who are making those purchase or no purchase decisions. In addition to that, I do recall, I'm not sure again, sort of time frame or anything like that. I don't know if it's in the context of this de-risking or not, but we have a broker dealer, and they asked if we could help sell any of the notes to other clients that we may have. I'm not sure if we actually did or not, but I do remember being asked to try to be a co-manager in some of those deals.
So early you mentioned, and again this is demonstrate my thickness of not being on the street, but when Cohen and Company, for example, is looking at buying a Class A, Class B, or Class C note from Merrill or anybody, depending on your evaluation of what that's worth, it's not a matter of buying it at par or less than par. It's a matter of adjusting the coupon.
Well, okay, so I think you're talking to the wrong person about how you make buy decisions on bonds, because I don't do that. I've never done that. I was pointing out from the perspective of just general market convention that if you have a new issue coming, it's most common to just adjust the spread, the coupon on the bonds, as opposed to adjusting the dollar price.
And the reason I ask is because, at least from what I see, the offering circular gets issued, right? And in the offering circular, it says LIBOR plus whatever,
right,
for each note.
Right.
So, but regardless of what the offering circular says, you can change the coupon?
No. Different time period. Before the coupon is set is what I was saying. That's why I was saying for a new issue, while it's all still being structured and negotiated, the common way to do it is you go out with a price range of, whatever, LIBOR plus 25 area, right? It may end up being needing to clear LIBOR plus 26. The convention is just to make that coupon LIBOR plus 26, set the note at par or thereabouts, and then it goes. Subsequent to that, it trades in the market wherever it trades, right? It could be a premium, discount, I guess more likely in this case, but does that make sense?
Yeah, the difference is just at timing. Closing is when you...
You can have pricing.
Okay,
when I went through, once you price it, you set the coupon, and it no longer changes from that point.
Okay. And generally,
it's about a month before closing.
Thank you. You anticipated my next question. Although I guess, I mean, certainly things can change in a month, can't they?
Yeah, but it's already, but it's whatever. I mean, once you do the trade, you do the trade, you know. It's like, right, buy stock.
Right.
And it goes down before you have to pay for it. You'd like not to have purchased it, but that's tough luck. You bought it, you know.
Okay.
So, I mean, trade date is when
pricing date is trade date.
Pricing date is trade date, exactly. Okay. And closing date is settlement date in the parlance of, you know, sort of stocks or whatever.
Okay. So let me, much more general, broad question. I mean, one of the things, obviously, we've seen, you know, as a commission in looking at the CDO market is that it generated a lot of losses for a lot of folks. And you know, you were in a unique position to in the CDO market. What are your views on what happened?
Regarding CDOs?
Yeah.
Well, I have a lot of views. First of all, I mean, CDO is just it can be anything, right? So I don't agree that CDOs had a lot of losses. CDOs backed by certain asset classes had a lot of losses in certain vintages too, right? So it isn't even that all asset-backed CDOs had a lot of losses. Depending on when they were done, they may have had no losses whatsoever, right? But certainly asset-backed, really primarily subprime-backed, non-agency mortgage-backed, asset-backed CDOs from certain vintages, principally 2006 and 2007, had a lot of losses. But it's an issue of the underlying assets, not of the CDOs. Mm-hmm. The CDO structure, as far as I know, worked exactly the way it was supposed to and is the same structure and process that was used for investment-grade corporate bonds and leveraged loans and munis, insurance, corporate bonds, all of which did just fine. Same process, same structure than the ones backed by subprime mortgages, a lot of losses. So I'm saying that it's the underlying asset that's the issue, not the CDOs. Completely lost on the media, but that's
I don't know if it's completely lost. But for the subprime CDOs 2006-2007 vintages, why do you think there's so many losses in those?
Well, I think this, from the CDO level, I think it's because the subprime mortgage bonds that went in them had a lot of losses. Why did those have a lot of losses?
Thank you.
I don't know. I'm not an expert on that stuff. Evidently and anecdotally at this point, we see, you know, a number of things. Housing prices declined. There was a lot of the standards for the underwriting were seemingly lax, or at least more lax than in the past. So, for example, verification of income, things like that. I'm not an expert on non-agency mortgages. There are a lot of other people that will have much more complete opinions on why that is. All I know is from the CDO side, that asset class of that vintage, you know, was the problem, not the CDO.
This is actually taking you way back to Peru.
Okay.
And you worked on some of the first, maybe you worked on the first, what was then called multi-sector ABS CDOs. Do you actually consider you worked on the first one that was done in the marketplace?
I believe it was the second one. I worked on a team that was doing, I think it was the second one.
And what was the name of that deal?
I think it was Dash.
Dash One.
Dash One.
And what was the first multi-sector deal when you did that? Was that done in Peru or somewhere else?
It was one of the big banks, I believe, foreign bank. I'd have to look into it a little bit more. But that was basically the template for Dash. But it's Re-Remix, you know Re-Remix. Re-Remix are basically asset-backed CDOs. Yeah, you've never done one either. But The re-remix are asset-backed CDOs, except they only contain remix, and they generally don't have a collateral manager. So it's not really that this is a new concept, taking portfolios of mortgage-backed securities and doing a new securitization with them. That's existed for decades before even Dash, right? What made Dash different was, again, two things. One, that it contained all other kinds of, it's what's called multi-sector, right? It had credit cards, autos, aircraft, student loans, et cetera. And secondly, it had a portfolio manager, you know, like a fund. So it really was not that new. If you're saying, oh, well, that's like sort of a new thing, it isn't. The fundamental thing was not new. It was just a slight variation on the thing that had existed for a long time. Or you're right.
I do not know the answer to this question, just to be clear. But I have some anecdotal information, which could be wrong, that the advance rates that were available in the REMIC market were quite different from the advance rates that one got in multi-sector CDOs. So I don't know if that's correct or not. Do you?
What time of period, Ken?
We're back in
1999, 2000.
We're back in Dash 1 days.
Yeah, 1998, 99, something like that.
I don't know.
That's a long time. Now we clarify that it was over a decade ago. I don't know. And I don't know if you did Dash just with mortgage-backed securities, whether that would have produced a different answer either. But ironically, you know, you fast forward to like the 2006-2007 vintage, they contained very little other assets, or almost all. They almost could have been re-remix, you know, 'cause they didn't have many other things other than mortgage assets in 2006-2007, so they're much closer to the re-remix itself.
So the parent, if you will, of the ABS CDO, you accept this, is really the multi-sector CDO. But then around 2002-2003, there started to be a significant shift in the collateral from the diverse types of ABS that you cited, plus manufactured housing, plus mutual fund fees, plus others, to a much more focused
mortgage.
Emphasis on mortgages.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yes. And yes, generally what happened is the investors expressed a strong preference for having more, you know, pure mortgage exposure and not some of these other asset classes.
And why was that?
That, you know, a lot of it is, I think that a lot of it goes to a lot of, you know, investing kind of issues generally, which is people look at the recent past and say, all right, well, extrapolate from the recent past. And so, in the recent past, at that point in time, 2003, et cetera, some of those other asset classes had more challenging performance issues than mortgages did. In reality, you know, things are cyclical, right? There are times when you want to be in aircraft leases and times when you don't. And times when you want to be in franchise and times when you don't. Times you want to be in mortgages and times you don't. They're investing cycles in these things. You know, they go through cycles.
So in the 03 to 06 time frame when you're at Merrill, were there ABS CDOs primarily MBS?
Yeah, they're almost all MBS. There were definitely other asset classes, but it was a smaller, as the cloud, it was a smaller percentage than, you know, in 2000 or 2001 or whatever. It was very heavily mortgage, almost exclusively.
And your opinion that change over time was investor driven?
Oh, absolutely. And there's no, I mean, unless you can't do these unless that's what the investors want. Well, I guess you could. You just take them down yourself, as we've discussed. But otherwise, you know, investors have to want it, or you can't keep doing it.
So some of my question was actually for understanding the history of all of this, for clarifying the history, some of which I know, some of which I do not know. I do have some more follow-on questions that I'm a little bit concerned that they relate to your years at Merrill.
Okay.
And
yeah, we should.
Sure.
We're done with the...
Yeah. So you want to pause it while the lawyers come back? So, Mr. Attorney, you had made the comment that it was the underlying collateral that you thought went wrong and that there was nothing wrong with the CDO methodology. CDO's been done with all different types of asset classes. I wanted to pursue that a little bit more. And we talked a little bit about the beginnings of this asset class being in the multi-sector, where you really did have exposure in some sense to different industries, airlines, credit cards, different types of industries. But as you said that investors were more interested in a purely mortgage CDO.
Yeah.
Then the question becomes, within the CDO structure, was the capital structure appropriately taking account of potential higher correlation of the mortgage assets, because you no longer had both airlines and mutual fund fees.
Right.
You now had all mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have a view as to that shift in asset class, and was there a sufficient thinking, whether it was by the rating agencies or the managers and the investors or the underwriters, as to whether the correlation assumption was correct?
Right. Well, I think first of all, there is a different correlation assumption. So it is assumed to be more correlated than if you had those other industries. That's the first point I'd make. The second point I'd make is that if the real difference in the correlation probably is that the sort of commercial versus consumer difference, because it's not clear that if a borrower defaults on their mortgage, they're not also defaulting on their credit cards or car loan or student loan, whatever. So, but anyway, all that's, you know, it's very theoretical, and it's impossible to sort of test the negative in the sense that if the credit quality just was what it was historically, whether the correlation would have made a difference. I don't know if you'll ever be able to test that. Maybe you can go into some lab and try it, but because the credit quality was so bad, you know, I think that overwhelms the correlation issue. And the way they, rating agencies, I understand it, you know, they have a process for how they come up with the ratings on the underlying mortgage-backed securities, which I don't know exactly what it is, but they have their process, and they're using, you know, sort of historical information, statistics about what was happening. Obviously, that did not accurately reflect what was going to happen, you know, when things went awry. But it's not clear to me that that is a correlation issue so much as just a pure credit issue.
Do you think investors had an understanding that the correlation could be, the correlated performance could be materially higher than predicted, materially higher than the models?
Again, I don't think it's a correlation issue. I think it's a credit issue. Remember that they You're familiar with the concept of a diversity score? diversity score in a portfolio of, you know, corporate bonds. Diversity score is a measure of correlation, actually, right? The higher the diversity score, the assumed lower amount of correlation. So if something has a assumed a lot of diversity, it's going to have a high diversity score, right? Low correlation. The I don't know the exact numbers. It's been a while since I've seen one, but the assumed diversity score, the assumed correlation on a corporate CDO is assumed to be very high diversity. If you compare that with an asset-backed CDO, they're markedly different. So there you put in front of an investor in a very simple single number something that says this is significantly more correlated as it has a significantly lower diversity score. I think the rough range of the numbers is something like in the, I should get it exactly, something in like the 50s versus like something in the teens. Hugely different. So yeah, I mean, I think that they, I mean, it's right there in the thing. You're much more correlated, much lower diversity score than a corporate, a CLO, let's say. So they weren't paying attention if they didn't understand that part. Again, I think it goes back to the issue that that isn't really the issue. It's a credit issue.
I'm going to switch subjects a little. You're approved, then you're CS, then you were recruited to Merrill. Were there elements in the platform at Merrill that made you think you could grow revenues more significantly there than at CS?
I mean, clearly I thought do a good business at Merrill, or I wouldn't have gone there. But one of the primary reasons for leaving CS to go to Merrill wasn't really about the difference in platform. It was that my bosses at CS had announced that they were leaving. So I really no longer had my sort of primary sponsors there. Like Jack DeMeo and John Crystal and Nasser Ahmed and all those guys. And a new boss was put in on top of me. We spent a little bit of time sort of talking about organization and what we planned to do, and it became clear that it wasn't necessarily going to be as enjoyable for me as it was under my old group. And so that, I think, was one of the primary driving factors.
Were there any suggestions or representations to you, made to you at Merrill, again, looking comparatively compared to what you would have been facing in CS, about access to balance sheet, distribution capability?
I mean, I don't remember specific discussions or, you know, exact terms, but I certainly felt as though and was led to believe that the resources would be, you know, sufficient to carry on a successful business. Balance sheet is one of those resources. Distribution capabilities and access to them is part of it as well. So, yeah, I believed that going in. Not based on anything I can show you tangibly, but just that was what they implied, and that was what I inferred.
So no specific commitments?
I don't remember any specific commitments. Okay,
thank you. Switching subjects again. Have you looked at the performance of the Merrill ABS CDOs that were done during your time there, compared to the market, compared to others?
I have not. Not any time recently. I think that, you know, while we were at Merrill, you know, there were people in the group, I think, who did monitor them and, you know, sort of check what was going on, but that was a while ago.
So, I asked a two-part question, which isn't fair, so I have to go back and ask a simpler question. Even since you were leaving Merrill, have you gone back and looked at the performance of the Merrill deals, even irrespective of looking at the rest of the market?
You know, not specifically. Anecdotally, from time to time, my role right now is not to be at that level of detail. There are people in our company who are very much familiar with the trade asset class, and they're very involved in it. I don't know if they're thinking about it in terms of Merrill versus non-Merrill, but they're just involved in the asset class. But that's not my role.
It could just be curiosity about how deals turned out.
Yeah. Well, I don't, based on anecdotal evidence that I've seen, I don't see a difference between Merrill versus non-Merrill deals. And I do think that, as I understand it, depending on, depends on the asset class, of course. So that's the primary driver, right? What the asset class is, where it is in the cycle. That's principally what drives the performance. So, over the time period from 2003 through 2005, if you roll forward into the performance, I believe that, the most challenged performance-wise of all of the transactions that we did then on the CDO side would be the 05 vintage ABS CDOs, and that the 04 would be significantly better than those, and the 03 significantly better than those. And that's just an ABS CDO. And then all of the CLOs did very well, as I understand it. And then, insurance-related ones did very well also, and bank ones were challenged for a lot of the same reasons relating to real estate. So it's, again, a real estate market issue primarily, centered around certain businesses.
Jumping again, AIG, a significant number of the ABS CDOs did involve AIG taking the super senior. Were you involved with discussions with AIG? How did that process work?
So I would have, sort of be similar to discussions with all kinds of other counterparties that we would have. The day-to-day discussions were done by others. Salespeople who covered AIG. And then there would be structuring people who would discuss specifics of the structure, things like that. But occasionally, issues would bubble up and I would have conversations with people over there.
Was there any understanding, even if not a formal agreement, that AIG would do X number of deals with you or would look at all the deals that you intended to do?
Not that I recall.
Was there any understanding in advance of starting to market a deal that what I'm trying to get at and inartfully asking is in terms of the timing of signing an engagement letter, deciding to market a deal, at what point in time did someone at Merrill approach someone at AIG to look at whether they wanted to do the super senior?
I think that there are probably a number of different conversations that would happen at different stages. I've mentioned before that sort of generally we're trying to gauge the investor interest just in setting up the banking pipeline, right? So that you know who wants what. So I think there's sort of those preliminary conversations, or they're ongoing. And then, but when you get down to sort of crunch time and you actually have an offering, then for sure, you know, people are going in and saying, all right, this is the proposed transaction, this is the proposed structure, et cetera, et cetera. And the conversations heat up, and eventually you reach an agreement, whether they want it or they don't. Does that answer your question?
I guess I'm trying to understand, was there some programmatic element of the process with AIG that facilitated the growth in the market? That facilitated your doing more deals?
I don't remember any program or anything like that. I think that they would look at, you know, every transaction that we brought to market. I don't know what percentage of them they were on. It seemed like a high percentage for the time that I was there, but I don't really know what that is. You know, if I had to pick a guess, I'd say like 40% or something like that. It's high, but probably not a majority.
And when AIG shifted and decided to stop and taking a significant proportion of these deals,
yes,
were you concerned that your volume would go down? Was that a shock to the market?
I think those are two different questions. I mean,
it
absolutely factored in to, you know, our estimates for what we were going to be doing, right? Because let's say they were a third or 40% of the investor demand for that type of product, right? That, you know, and then they announced that they're not going to be doing that anymore. Obviously, that you have to factor that in. I call it concern. I mean, I'm always concerned about everything, right? So you factor it in. You say, all right, well, they're not there. Or there are other guys who want that, and it does feed into you know, the general budget and your estimate for what you're going to be doing. Turns out, I didn't stay around long enough to sort of see that through to the next step, which is to actually work on the other investors that would replace their demand. But, you know, as it turns out, at least in 2006, as you said, there were ample other investors to replace that demand, so much so that Merrill did three or more times the amount of volume in 2006 than they did in 2005 on the same products. And that was before, as I think you said, before they were even taking any of the exposure back themselves, so they clearly had the demand.
I want to shift subjects again. I don't want to monopolize it anymore. Did Merrill have any, what I'll roughly call, I don't want this to be a technical term, roughly called joint ventures with any asset managers that you helped finance their business, get them started in some way?
I mean, there's one program I remember where, you know, Merrill would make seed capital investments in hedge funds. I guess that, and some of those guys could be managers, but not necessarily. There's sort of a broad range of guys. I don't remember anything else, you know, sort of programmatic, if that's what you mean. I mean, just, you know, doing transactions is helpful for growing a business, but I don't think it's like, okay, here we're going to start and grow a business. I don't think it was formalized or JV, as you said. I don't remember anything like that.
So do you recall that there was seed capital provided to any managers for whom Merrill did
ABS CDOs?
I'm going to look at the list I have.
The list of Merrill's ABS CDOs? I don't recall, but I'm just going to list it. I know that's the only, you know, sort of program I can think of that rose to the level of being a program.
And on the prior page, there's like five of them.
I mean, I know of no, you know, sort of formal program with any of these guys.
Who would negotiate the fees with the collateral managers? Who would negotiate the agreements?
The banker responsible for the client would generally be like a Lars Norell or a Brenda Silva or Bill Berry or whatever. I would get involved sometimes in that as well.
Do you have to approve them?
Well, there's every transaction manager, the whole thing is approved by a committee consisting of senior executives, legal, compliance, support and operations. It's like a commitment committee, right? What do we call it? I forget what it's called. But basically every transaction is taken, so I'm sure you had it at Fair as well, or you take, it's like an investment banking committee or whatever. You take the transaction and say, all right, this is the proposed transaction, this is who the issuer, manager is, this is the relevant terms, and it needs to be approved by this group of senior people from all different functions. So yes, that happened on every transaction. It wasn't just that I had to approve it. I was really more the one sort of taking the deal to the committee for approval.
And how big was the commitment committee or whatever it was called?
How many people?
Yeah.
It was roughly 12 people. There's one for credit products and there's one for mortgage products. There were two different. Yeah, some of the people overlapped, but most of them were separate people. Risk management was heavily involved in this as well.
Do you recall doing deals for what would be referred to as first-time managers, again, just ABS, CBOs? Was that...
Are these, okay, by date?
And you can skip any of the large institutions.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if it was PIMCO's first deal or not, or TCW's first deal or not.
Did you print on the back of some other document?
Yes, I did. Okay. Yes, so ignore the back.
Ignore the back.
I'm being environmentally friendly, too.
Yeah. Looking at the list, maybe that was Terwin's first national back CDO, maybe. Maybe that was Maxim's first, but I can't be sure.
You said that you're talking about the 2004 deal?
Whatever the first one that they did, yeah. They did multiple deals, I'm just talking about the first one that they... I left, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so like eyeballing it, you know, of the, whatever that is, 30-something transactions, maybe two or three were first-time managers while I was there. Rough numbers. We can verify the exact facts, but, you know, that's what it roughly looks like. I mean, obviously, some of you said, you know, some of these very big PIMCO, Fisher Francis, et cetera, just some big guys.
And when you were marketing when you were either deciding to do that transaction or separately when you were marketing that transaction, was it somehow a different or a different process, more difficult, anything different?
I would say that, generally speaking, There's a higher level of scrutiny and investor resistance on a first-time manager versus an established manager, which is one of the reasons why, you know, you can't just have a pipeline full of first-time managers. You're going to have an occasional one. I mean, everyone has to be the first time once, or they'll never be there, right? So, there's a higher level of scrutiny. Investors really would, you know, kick the tires significantly more first-time manager, test them out, et cetera.
Was there, did you find any difference in their purchase decisions of collateral between a first-time manager and a more established name?
Not.
Because they're purchasing of collateral.
Sure. Not that I can say, but, you know, again, they, investors were harsher on first-time managers. And I think that all other things being equal, they may have, you know, looked into the ringer a bit more, including on what their asset portfolio was going to be. You mentioned AIG before. You can see there are, you know, in a lot of these transactions, they had a process for their own due diligence, and it was thorough. A lot of the other insurance guys too, and just generally investors, they had a harsh process.
You had mentioned a little while ago that when you would take deals to the commitment committee, that some of the people on that committee were the risk managers or the risk manager at Merrill. What other dealings did your group have with the risk management function other than getting deals approved or not approved at the commitment committee?
Mm-hmm. Well, the principal dealings with the risk management department would be from the trading side, because that's really because the business risk managers are the traders. We, as non-traders, are not allowed to, you know, take risk positions. We can't buy, sell bonds, commit the firm to a trade. Right? Only the traders can do that. And so, risk management people are there to work with the traders and establish risk limits and metrics for risk and all the rest. So we're dealing with them indirectly, but probably the time we dealt with the most was as it related to the warehouse, because we're structuring, bank construction group is involved in the warehouse, even though the warehouse is the responsibility of the trading desks, depending on which asset class it is. We're clearly involved because we're, you know, it's the warehouse is part is being done to do a transaction, right? So we would get the reports, and we would, you know, be involved in the dialogue of, okay, what's the pipeline, what's the timing of the deals, things like that. But so I would say that our involvement with the risk manager is mostly about centered around the warehouses, and, you know, being in dialogue with them, principally about, you know, how things are moving through the pipeline.
How would you, or can you, you know, compare the risk management function at Merrill in terms of robustness, et cetera, to, you know, Prue and CSFB?
I don't really know if I'm the best person to make that assessment. You know, I wasn't a trader. I dealt with them sort of tangentially.
Anybody, while you were at Merrill, ever tell you or have discussions with anyone about concerns about risk management not being emphasized enough within the organization?
Not that I recall.
Anybody ever tell you, or do you ever hear from anybody ever tell you, or did you hear that anyone at Merrill was concerned that the risk management function was too far removed from the CEO position at the company?
I don't recall anyone. On the CEO position?
For Mr. O'Neill, yes.
I don't recall any such conversation.
Okay. Getting close. Generalized question on Merrill. Look, and I can do this since you left in February of 06, but looking back, what do you see as the major problems that led to their demise or to their acquisition by BFA?
I mean, it's hard to say with, you know, any specific answer because, like you said, I wasn't sort of there at the time, and the sort of recent history leading up to the time of their demise, as you called it. But, you know, they were clearly exposed to mortgage and other real estate assets that had a, you know, unprecedented and enormous drop in value. So that's clearly the issue. It's probably not just mortgage stuff, because there's also some other things that were non-mortgage related that dropped in value for a while, subsequently recovered for the most part. But at that time, like a lot of things dropped in value. I mean, even just corporate bonds, you know, investment grade corporate bonds, blue chip companies, the market values dropped precipitously. But they were, you know, long a lot of, you know, credit and otherwise illiquid assets that dropped a lot in value, and they couldn't sort of get out from under them.
Even broader question, as I said in the very beginning, when I gave that opening spiel, our task, of course, is to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis. I'm looking way beyond Merrill and looking at the causes of the financial crisis. Any opinions on what you believe that the primary causes were?
Absolutely. Many opinions. As I see it, it goes directly to the system that was effectively imported from foreign universal banks, where you have a system where you try to combine investment banking, securities trading within federally insured deposit taking, and therefore, you know, systemically important institutions, and they're really not supposed to be mixed. But we got that right when we put Glass-Steagall in place the first time. And then, you know, as the foreign universal banks continue to, you know, chip away at the U.S. investment banks' market share, and the commercial bankers are saying, well, we really want to get into, you know, investment banking and securities activities, they, of course, lobbied to get into it, right? That's one thing. And the other thing they did is they did things that were outside of the exact definition of securities, like swaps, right? And effectively got into securities sort of backdoor away. But all of it is just basically centers around the same issue, which is that, you know, you are encouraging using, you know, subsidized insured deposits to carry on risky activities. And in my opinion, they shouldn't be mixed. And that's what basically creates several of the problems. One is that it makes the system, you know, too fragile. So you didn't know exactly that, you know, the subprime mortgage problem was going to happen. It didn't have to be that. It could have been, you know, sort of anything that sort of went awry. It was risky and then dropped into a fragile system. And then you have to do all this other stuff to help it up. And then you get to the point where you are right now, and a lot of the conclusions have, I think, been, you know, off base as well. So it goes to the sort of issue of the shadow banking thing, right? People attack securitization. You need securitization. You don't need commercial banks to be an investment bank. But you need some way to bridge the gap between sort of savers and borrowers. Securitization is the perfect way to do that. And it's attacked, and people wonder why, you know, we don't have more lending going on in the country now. Well, we attacked the best system we had to provide lending, and we're still attacking it from a regulatory and political and media standpoint.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I mean, I hear you talking about the commercial banks, you know,
Graham Leach Bliley and taking on more risk-insured deposits. But all the investment banks weren't commercial banks, and basically they're the ones that got in trouble way before the, not way before, but before the commercial bank. So how do you address that?
Because in a competitive environment, when your competitor is usually using, you know, subsidized borrowing to carry on their business, and they're generating an ROE of whatever, but their borrowing cost is subsidized because they're, you know, insured deposits, what other thing? You can either just, you know, tell your shareholders that I'm not going to be competitive, or you can ramp up your leverage, which is what they chose to do to get the same ROE. They responded to competitive stimulus. Now, was it right? I don't know. I mean, I wasn't, you know, you have to talk to different people about how they're making those decisions, but there was pressure on the leaders of the traditional investment banks to generate attractive returns for shareholders, or they're going to be out of business that way. You know, if you can't get shareholders to fund a company, you're going to die a slow death that way. So,
I do have some other big picture questions. We want you to make your plane. So I will stop when you need to leave your plane, and this may not take long anyway. You left in some measure when all the different sorts of synthetic exposures to mortgages started really ramping up. But you left Merrill, but you are still involved in this marketplace. So do you have a view as to how the various developments, and we can go through them one by one, or you can talk about them generally, the mortgage credit derivatives and how that changed the market?
Sure. So, I mean, the issue of credit derivatives is a big issue. The principal, you know, problem is, as it relates to, you know, the financial crisis and the stability of the system, is that they're basically done under a system of assumed too big to fail. I mean, that's the reason that, you know, a small company can't enter into credit default swaps is because they're not assumed to be too big to fail. So it's a system that reinforces the too big to fail nature, and I welcome the what I hope will be real changes when these instruments go on to central clearing, but more importantly, central clearing, an open architecture which allows them to look more like other derivatives, like options. No one ever talks about options, ever, you know, stock options or whatever, ever being a problem for the stability of the system because there's so many different participants and it's a diffused risk. And they're highly volatile. Stock options are highly volatile, but it doesn't matter. You can't bring down the system because it's just diffused risk. Individual players can blow themselves up, but they're small, and so it doesn't really matter to the system. So, I mean, in general, that is the biggest issue with credit default swaps and other swaps, and hopefully that's been addressed through the legislative process. We'll have to see if it works in practice. The mortgage derivatives are just one other type. You know, like I said, the problem happened to be most acute in mortgages and subprime mortgages of certain vintages, but it didn't have to be. It could have been high yield. And we'd seen other high yield related problems even in the same decade. So that isn't so much the problem. The problem is the way the system is set up. So you only have these interconnected participants.
So to ask a more specific question, one school of thought, is that the development of derivatives in some way kept the market going and kept the market growing, either because it allowed for new sorts of trading activities which generated interest, or because existing players could hedge certain parts of their exposure and therefore were willing to do more, grow more, because part of it was hedged. do you have an opinion about that school of thought?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, look, I mean, the reason that you have derivatives, right, is that one group of people, you know, want to hedge or speculate, it doesn't really matter, and the other group of people, you know, want to get exposure to something. That's why you have derivatives, that's why you have, you know, stock options and futures and commodities or all these different things. Mortgage derivatives are really not any different in that sense. In that sense, right? That it's a good thing to have people having the ability to hedge, right? And others who are, you know, want to take on exposure, you know, speculate effectively and getting long exposure on whatever the thing you're referencing in the derivatives. I mean, that's why we have futures and all these other things. That part is good. Problem is the system around it was not stable, right? If all the same things that happened, you know, on the Board of Trade, Chicago Board of Trade, it would have been a non-event, right?
Mr. Ricciardi, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. 5:30.